As we have been discussing all these days, the question of consciousness, and we have defined consciousness as life looking outwards. Consciousness is the expression of life, the relationship between life and consciousness is all the time moving, it is not static. And therefore, there is not just one door through which life looks at form, the outer world, but there are many, many doors. And we are considering this question of the movement of consciousness. In this discussion of the movement of consciousness, we saw yesterday that our consciousness is at present focused at the level of the mind. The mind is the center from where consciousness carries on its activities. And this consciousness focused at the level of the mind is, as we saw yesterday, a successive consciousness. We see things successively, one after the other. The mind is not able to perceive all at once, but only one after the other. That is the successive consciousness. And we are trying to find out whether it is possible for us to move from this point of successive consciousness to what we have described as the simultaneous consciousness. Since we are going to go into the question of meditation, we will have to find out this method of moving from successive to simultaneous. Successive consciousness is a consciousness which cannot have the perception of the whole. It sees things in fragments. And therefore, it is a fragmentary consciousness, not the consciousness of the whole. And we have described meditation as perception of the whole. Of course, the whole cannot be perceived. Whole is greater than the total, we have seen it. That whole is not identical with the total. Whole is greater than the sum of the parts. We have discussed that. This perception of the whole is not possible by the mind because of the very activity of the mind of breaking up, of splitting up, of fragmenting anything that it wants to consider. So from the fragmentary consciousness, which is ours, we are thinking in terms of meditation to move on to that point of consciousness where there is the perception of the whole. The perception of the whole, whether it is possible or it is not possible, it is a different matter. But meditation is fundamentally the experience of the whole. The experience of the whole is then communicated, is conveyed. It is transmitted. When it is transmitted, whether it remains whole or it does not remain whole, that is the subject which we are going to consider tomorrow when we talk of the communication of the unmanifest with the manifest. We are just now concerned with the movement from the manifest to the unmanifest because that is the movement with which meditation is concerned. Now, meditation is a very loaded word. There are many, many things which are spoken about as meditation. But one thing we must bear in mind, that meditation is not just an event, that I decide to sit in meditation in the morning or in the evening or whenever it is convenient. That is not meditation. Meditation is a process. and the process continues. Process must continue. There may be culminating points of that process, and it is the culminating process of that culminating point of that process which can be described as the act of sitting down. Act of sitting down, because generally we associate meditation with a certain sitting posture, but that sitting posture by itself is not important. It has no validity if it does not emerge out of the process. And therefore we must consider meditation as a process, and also as the process from time to time coming to a culminating point, which is an event. Meditation is both event and a process, and we must understand the process and the event as clearly as possible, as it is possible for us to understand. Meditation has been defined and described in many of the books of ancient or Hindu psychology. Since we are examining the whole subject in the context of Hindu psychology, the fundamentals of Hindu psychology, we must bear in mind the Hindu scriptural texts, as I said this morning, are many. And in all the scriptural texts of the Hindus, meditation is indicated in one particular manner. In order that we may be able to meditate, for example, we get assistance from the statements in the Bhagavad Gita or the statements in the yoga aphorisms of Patanjali, or we get assistance from the statements in the Upanishads, because these are the major expressions of Hindu psychology. And if you turn, for example, to the Bhagavad Gita defines meditation in just a half a sentence, not even a full sentence, just in half sentence, the Bhagavad Gita defines what meditation is. It gives an illustration. In the Sanskrit language, in the Bhagavad Gita, it is said, yatha dipo nivatastho nengate. This is just a short statement describing or defining what meditation is. It says, just as the flame is without a flicker, when the state is a windless state, in a windless state, the flame is without a flicker, so is the state of meditation. The flame without a flicker. And what is it that produces flicker? That which produces the flicker is the breeze, the wind that comes. And therefore there has to be a windless state. And in that windless state, this experience of flame without the flicker can be understood. Now what is this windless state? From where does the wind come? From where does the breeze come? The breeze, so far as our psychological life is concerned, so far as the mind is concerned, naturally the wind comes from the movement of thought. The movement of thought produces this breeze, and it is in the movement of thought, because of the blowing of the breeze, the flame shakes, the flame flickers, and therefore the Bhagavad Gita says, you must come to a condition where there is no breeze of thought, because in that absence of the breeze of thought, it is possible for us to understand what the state where there is a flame, but the flame does not flicker at all. The mind must come to a state of a flame. In other words, the mind must be tremendously active. Tremendously active. As one of the former presidents of the Theosophical Society put it, that this is a condition where the thinking faculty is tense and yet not thinking. The thinking faculty is tense. The former president of the Theosophical Society is Mr. C. Janarajadas, and he said in one of his writings that the thinking faculty is tense, it is active, it is ready to burst out, and yet it does not. And therefore, in meditation, we do not carry a mind that is dull, a mind that is indolent, so that there is no capacity to think. There is tremendous capacity to think, and yet the mind does not think. In spite of the capacity, the mind does not think. Why? Why does not the mind think? Why does the thought process cease? Because something must have happened to bring about this cessation of the thought process. In other words, it is a process where the mind understands how far it can go and where it cannot go. What is the limit of the mind? And therefore, in meditation, we are concerned with the mind finding out for itself where it can go, where it cannot go. And therefore, there is no question of outer discipline, that the mind must be stopped. The mind must not be allowed to go further. The mind itself knows. The intelligent mind knows. And we have gone into the question as to what we mean by an intelligent mind. We have said that the mind that knows its possibilities, but the mind that also knows its limitations, is an intelligent mind. It is the mind which is not intelligent which rushes. For example, the mind that is not intelligent will say, oh yes, I know God, I know reality, I can tell you what it is. But remember, all the responses of the mind with regard to the areas which are outside its limit are bound to remain incomplete. And therefore, we get some intimations of reality as conveyed to us by the mind, but all those intimations represent an experience which is incomplete. In fact, mind never completes anything. Mind is interested in leaving things incomplete. I very often give an example which is applicable not here but in India, that the mind is like a building contractor. In India, the building contractor will go on giving promises. Oh, he's finishing, but always postpones, because the mind is not interested in completing anything. Why is it so? Because the mind can go on when things are incomplete. Completion is the death of the mind, and the mind does not want to die, because completion means there is no further thought process. But the mind is interested in continuing the thought process. And therefore, mind always functions in the campus of continuity. Mind does not know what discontinuity is. Continuity is the only sphere in which the mind functions. In fact, if you go into the question, we'll find that we want to solve all problems in the sphere of continuity. We talk of death, and we want to understand death in terms of continuity. And that is what we have done. The traditional discussion, or maybe theosophical discussion, in all these discussions, death is considered as in terms of the after-death condition. But death cannot be understood by knowing the after-death condition. Death is something completely different. Death is the moment of discontinuity. And therefore, by no effort of continuity can discontinuity be understood. This is with regard to everything. For example, reincarnation, we talk of reincarnation. Can the secret of reincarnation be understood in terms of continuity? It cannot be. Because if reincarnation can be understood in terms of continuity, then it is just a repetition. It is a principle of recurrence. As I was, so I will be. And therefore, it is a repetition. But reincarnation is not repetition. Reincarnation can become intelligent only when we are able to examine it in the background of renewal, not in the background of our continuity, but in the background of renewal. One can speak about all these various things with which we are familiar so far as the philosophical, psychological discussions are concerned. There is a factor of continuity, and our consciousness, as it is rooted, is interested only in moving in that continuity, maintaining that continuity, and resisting any effort where the continuity is broken. But here in meditation, we are discussing that experience where the continuity of consciousness is broken. It is no longer in the field of continuity. On the contrary, meditation is the experience of the arrival of the moment of discontinuity. It is in terms of this discontinuity that meditation can become intelligible. Otherwise, meditation becomes just a routine, a ritual. As it has become with many of us, meditation is just a ritual, just a ceremonial. But meditation is not a ritual, not a ceremonial. Meditation is a moment of creativity. And where can creativity come? Creativity can come only in moments of discontinuity, not in the periods of continuity. And therefore, it is not continuity that can explain the meaning of meditation. It is only when we are aware of the moments of discontinuity that it is possible for us to enter into the secret of meditation. Of course, I am using the word when we are aware, but we have gone into the question as to what is this we. Because discontinuity is not merely in the process of meditation. Discontinuity is of the meditator himself. So long as the meditator continues, meditator is the mind. So long as the mind continues, there is no prospect of our deriving any result, any benefit, so far as meditation is concerned. And therefore, meditation has to be understood as in terms of the Bhagavad Gita, that there is a period where there is no wind that is blowing, no breeze that is blowing, and in that not blowing of the breeze, there is an experience where the flame does not flicker. The flame is absolutely steady. In the Bhagavad Gita, at another place it says that whenever your mind wanders away, and the mind does wander away, that is our experience. The only experience that we have with regard to meditation is that our mind wanders. The wandering of the mind is our experience. But the Bhagavad Gita says, whenever your mind wanders, bring it back gently, not forcibly. Bring it back gently where? Not to the point where you started, but bring it back gently to the state where the mind is quiet. Bring it back gently to the silence of the mind, where there is no noise, absolutely, where there is silence, and therefore bring gently, not forcibly, but bring gently nearer and nearer to the area where the mind is quiet, the mind is silent. And therefore, talking in the background of what we have been discussing just now, one can say that the silence of the mind is a condition which is imperative so far as the experience of meditation is concerned. But can mind be silent, made silent? Can one come to the silence of the mind by an effort of the mind? It cannot. Because any effort that is made by the mind is an effort with motive. Because mind does not do anything without a motive. It may be what we call good motive, bad motive, but without motive, the mind does not do anything. And it is the touch of motive which is the touch which pollutes. And therefore in meditation we have to be away from this touch of motive. And the touch of motive, it is very, very difficult to keep it out. Because anything that is done with a motive, and therefore meditation has been rightly described as an act of observation. But who is observing? Is it the mind that is observing? Of course, in the initial stage, it is the mind that is observing. We will go into this question, very interesting, fascinating question of observation. Observation without the observer. Because if there is observation with the observer, then once again all the motives that were there, they once again come into existence. Observation without the observer. But you can't start. You can't say, just tomorrow morning I will sit down and begin to observe. It's not so easy. The observation is not so easy, and therefore there has to be an earlier preparation. And the earlier preparation is that before we go into meditation, whether we enter the process of meditation or not, there must be first of all the ground of total relaxation. It should be possible for us to experience complete relaxation. Without relaxation, without the experience of relaxation, without this background of relaxation, it will not be possible for us to go into the experience of meditation. And therefore one has to come to a state of relaxation, complete relaxation. And one has to find out what is the way by which the person can come naturally to a state of relaxation. We have to find out. Because it will differ from person to person, from individual to individual, where we can naturally go into a state of relaxation. Some people there may be who by listening to music can go naturally into a state of relaxation. Some slow music, quiet music is played or sung, and it is that enough, that thing is enough to bring the mind to a state of relaxation. Or somebody may relax as looking at nature. Looking at nature one can find. Whatever it is, one must find out what enables him or her to come to a state of relaxation. Not forcible relaxation. There is a book which is entitled, You Must Relax. The moment you say you must relax, then it means you have to make an effort to relax. But that very effort to relax brings us to a condition of greater and greater tension. We all live in a world of tension, in circumstances of tension, increasing tension, and therefore in the midst of these tensions, it is not possible for us to come to the experience of meditation. One must find some time. It is not necessary to run away, but wherever we are, one must be able to find time in order to come to the experience of relaxation. Lying down, sitting, walking, looking at nature, listening to music, whatever it is something which each person has to find out for himself so that he is in a state of relaxation. In that state of relaxation, there is no effort whatsoever, whatever it is. Because you are not trying to drive away the thoughts which you do not like. Let them remain. But whatever it is, if you can come to a state of relaxation, then that is the background in which there is the possibility of going further into the field of meditation. Meditation requires, first of all and last of all, a state of energy. We must find the secret of regeneration. Leave apart the regeneration of other people, but we must be able to discover our own secret of regeneration. I discussed this yesterday, and so I do not want to go over that ground again, that it is possible for us to find out the secret of regeneration. If we are a living organism and not a mechanistic organism, if we function only in the ground of habit, if everything is habitual, then we have developed a mechanistic organism. But if it is a living organism, and what is the characteristic of a living organism? The living organism is flexible. It's very, very flexible. In fact, it is vulnerable. J. Krishnamurti used to say very often that to live is to be vulnerable. You can be attacked from all sides, but you are not closing down. You are prepared to receive attack from wherever it comes. You are prepared to receive the impulses and impacts from wherever they come. That is the state of vulnerability. It is a state of openness. It is this which is necessary so far as the generation of energy is concerned. Then you can apply those methods which we discussed yesterday, the method of visualization, so that you are able to place yourself in a condition which is pleasant, which is happy. I would like to, just by way of indication, I want to say that the Hindu philosophy, the Hindu psychology, did not have the background of sorrow or suffering. It never grew out of suffering. Just as the Buddhist philosophy, the Jain philosophy, to a certain extent the Christian philosophy, the Islamic philosophy, it has grown in the background of suffering. Suffering is the background because these religions have a founder. And because they have a founder, wherever the founder is crucified, there is the question of suffering. But since Hinduism has no founder at all, nobody knows who established Hinduism, and therefore Hinduism has not the background of suffering and sorrow. In fact, Hinduism has the background of ananda, of joy. Joy is the stream in which Hindu thought has grown, and therefore we must understand that this is the background in which Hindu psychology also has developed. Not that suffering and sorrow has no value. Suffering and sorrow have values. We have to understand the value, because it is only in suffering and in sorrow that the person is able to become aware of the limitations of the mind, where the mind cannot do anything. The mind cannot find any way. You come to a crisis, and coming to the crisis is very, very important. And this crisis is very often brought about by our experience of suffering. What shall I do? Where shall I go? What path shall I take? There is no path that is available to me. When the mind comes to the state of crisis, the state which is critical, then that is the state in which suffering is experienced, but that is also the state where new openings come into existence, where you are able, not by the effort of the mind, but by some unknown effort, by some unknown grace, whatever you want to call it, by some unknown factor, it is possible for you to discover the way where the mind was not able to discover. And therefore, suffering has a value. Sorrow has a value. Because if suffering does not come, if sorrow does not come, then probably we will become individuals that merely vegetate. There is no living element at all. But as I said, wherever there is the living organism, not a mechanistic organism, there regeneration is possible. Whether it is in an organization, whether it is in a country, whether it is in a society, or whether it is in the context of the individual. Regeneration is possible where the system is a living system. And therefore we have to find out whether our system is a living system or it is a mechanistic system. That is why the definition of yoga that is given by Patanjali, the very first statement of yoga is, yoga is mind freed completely from habit. Completely freed from habit. Chitta vritti nirodha yoga. That is the definition of yoga that is given by Patanjali. When the mind is completely free from all habit, we find that we are living our lives very much in terms of habit. Wherever life is a habitual life, done by habit, you may call it good habit or bad habit, it doesn't matter. But no habit is good, because it is the habit which creates the degenerative process. Where the mind is completely freed from habit, then we are ready to become a living organism, and the living organism has the possibility of regenerating itself. We will not go further into this question, because this is not the subject with which we are concerned so far as this discussion is concerned. But regeneration is possible only when there is a living system. If it is not a living system, then regeneration is not possible. Then it will come to an end, the inevitable end. It will die. Then it will come to an end, the inevitable end. It will die, because that is the only prospect in front of a system which is not a living system. If you and I can create a living system, and meditation is possible only in a living system, meditation is not possible in a mechanistic system. And therefore, in moments of relaxation, it is possible for us to get back the living quality of our system. When this living quality of system is there, then it is possible for us to go step by step into the subject of meditation. All of us know that in meditation, whatever we call it, whether it is a meditation which is of a particular type or of a different type, meditation demands, as we all of us know, first of all, a state of concentration. My mind must be able to concentrate on something. My mind must remain steady on that particular point, whatever may be the point. But my subject of meditation must not move away, or my mind must not move away from the subject of meditation. It should be possible for me to keep as long as I like the mind on that particular subject. And therefore, we need concentration. But this concentration we have not understood properly. And that is why concentration becomes a problem, one of the stumbling blocks so far as the movement of meditation is concerned. Remember, concentration is possible. And that is what Patanjali says. Patanjali defines what concentration is. I'm talking of Patanjali because the whole of our discussion all these days has been with reference to the Hindu psychology. And since we are talking of Hindu psychology, in the field of Hindu psychology, Patanjali occupies a very, very important position, because Patanjali's yoga system is nothing but a psychological approach to the problem of yoga, the problem of meditation. And therefore, Patanjali discusses this question of concentration. Why are we not able to concentrate? First of all, we are unable to concentrate because we are not fundamentally interested in the subject. Yes, so we are ready with questions, since the photograph is out of the mind.
Do you think it is possible to give them any kind of
if they first of all learn relaxation, the releasing of energy, concentration, then it is possible. And these are the things which can be taught. They should be taught in the home or in the school. I think it's quite possible. I don't see any difficulty. Is it possible to teach these methods of meditation in a home where children are raised, or in a school where you are in touch with children? Is it possible? And I stated, yes, it is possible. The initial stages of meditation, namely relaxation, if children can be taught how to relax, completely relax, if this energy about which I have talked, if that could be taught. Of course, children don't need the awakening of energy because they have plenty of energy. But we can teach them these early lessons of concentration. Then I'm sure they would be ready to go further into the subject of meditation. Yes? You see, now the distance has grown between the speaker and the... So if you can...
If one has a mystical experience...
Mystical experience, yes.
What does man say in Hindu tradition, that one is in unity with Brahman or with Purusha or Prakriti?
The unity with reality. Brahman is the word which is used. But that is the unity with reality. It doesn't last. It doesn't, now I'm one with the Brahman and so I have nothing else to do. It comes and goes. As one of the Upanishads says, yoga comes and goes. You can't just sit back and say, now I have had the experience. There have to be the intervals of continuity and discontinuity. And therefore a living organism can move away and then return. That is the natural process. The person who has realized oneness with the Brahman, because Brahman is not static, Brahman is not steady, that here is Brahman and I have found my unity. Brahman itself is the experience of mobility. And therefore, you can't say that I have realized Brahman. The moment you say I have realized Brahman, the realization is broken. And therefore, the person who has realized Brahman doesn't speak about it. Goes on. And therefore the experience of realization is not once and for all. One has to come to realization again and again, again and again. He can come quickly, but nevertheless the experience has to be intermittent. There can be no continuity so far as that experience is concerned. Purusha. But who is Purusha and who is Brahman? The Purusha is the same as Brahman. Purusha is not different from Brahman. We have come to the experience of silence. Purusha and Brahman are the words that are used. Sometimes Purusha by himself is unmanifest. And when Purusha manifests himself, then comes into existence what is called Prakriti. Brahman by himself or itself is unmanifest. When Brahman wants to manifest himself, then comes the world into existence. In fact, in Hindu psychology, there is much discussion about the male and the female aspect of consciousness. The male aspect of consciousness is the unmanifest aspect. It is only when Shiva wants to express himself that Shakti becomes active. Shakti is the active representation of that consciousness. Shiva by himself doesn't do anything. Shiva is just there. And when Shiva wants to speak, wants to express, then Shakti comes into existence. The Shakti is the female aspect of consciousness. Shiva is the male aspect. And therefore all expression, that is the work of Shakti, that is the work of the female principle. If there are no questions, we might as well disperse. Or we can take up tomorrow, if you want to brood over the matter. Because you may not yet be ready with the questions. Then perhaps we can have some questions tomorrow morning when we talk of the manifest and the unmanifest. But as I said, meditation is a process. The process which commences from relaxation and goes up to the point where we have observed the movement of the conscious mind. In that observation of the conscious mind, we come to the highest experience of meditation. In other words, the mind observes itself. The mind observes itself at the subconscious level, the mind observes itself at the conscious level, and in that very act of observation, because mind has observed itself in that very act of observation, for the time being, the mind is completely silent, completely quiet. It may once again become active, that's a different manner. But its activity will be of a different quality than the quality which was there earlier. This is the process. Meditation never ends. Meditation is life itself, and therefore it has to go on during the whole period of life. From the period when one is awake, one is alert so far as meditation is concerned, it goes on. And it is so enjoyable that one doesn't feel that one is, as it were, engaged in something for which he needs to exert. There is no exertion whatsoever. It is as quiet, as simple as anything. But the difficulty...
conscious mind begins to observe itself in the mirror of relationship. How can you act? Because you will be so much involved in observation that situation may demand action. And because you are lost,
We are not talking of action. We are talking of observation by which the mind comes to acquire a state of silence. Then from the silence the action emerges. Not while you are observing. You can observe the conscious mind in the midst of your daily activities. Perhaps you may have to interrupt your daily activities, but doesn't matter. Whenever you can observe, observe the subconscious and the conscious mind. And when you come to silence, because silence is the ground of innocence, it is the ground of inaction about which the Bhagavad Gita speaks. And as the Bhagavad Gita says, your true action emerges from inaction. Whatever emerges out of that silence, the innocence of silence, that is good. It is absolutely good. It is not good relatively. It is not good in opposition to bad, because you have moved away from the dualities of the mind, and therefore you have come to the understanding of the absolute good, and the absolute good comes into existence only in the ground of innocence, in the ground of inaction, in that ground where the conscious mind, the subconscious mind, they have become quiet. And therefore we are not bothered about action. The actor is no longer there. The actor with all his motivations, he has disappeared with the quieting of the mind. And therefore there is this ground of innocence that is created. The ground of inaction is that created. Then don't bother. Anything that emerges out of that ground of inaction is bound to be good. Yes.
What is the? I've heard this not all lectures, but what is it? You talked about buddhi, and what is exactly the experience in meditation? Is it buddhi, or is it still something else?
We talked about buddhi yesterday. Buddhi is intelligence. It is beyond the mind. The mind can function as an instrument of intellect. But as the Bhagavad Gita says, higher than the mind is buddhi. Buddhi is intelligence, intuition, insight, call it by whatever name you like. And the action that emerges from insight is an action of a completely different order from the action that emerges from the intellect. Our actions, they emanate from intellect. But if we have come to the experience of buddhi, the experience of intelligence, then it is an action which is of a completely different nature. And it comes, it naturally comes. Buddhi or intelligence expresses itself. And every expression of intelligence is something which has the quality of absolute good. It is not good as opposed to bad, but it has the quality of absolute good. And therefore, we are talking of intelligence. Meditation is the awakening of intelligence. But the awakening of intelligence takes place when the activity of the intellect for the time being is quiet. So long as the intellect acts, so long it is not possible for the intelligence to come in. Then again we will use intellect, because for the purposes of communication we need intellect. But it will be special condition. We have to go deeper, and that deeper condition is, there must come into existence the silence of the conscious mind, not merely the silence of the subconscious mind, but the silence of the conscious mind. How is this to be brought about? Once again, by observation. But can the conscious mind observe itself? Can the conscious mind be the observer and the field of observation may be the conscious mind? Is it possible? I suggest it is possible. The conscious mind can look at itself. How? We all of us know that we have not directly seen our faces. Nobody has seen directly his face. And yet we recognize ourselves. We recognize our faces because we have seen our own faces in the mirror. In the mirror, every morning when I shave, I look at myself and I recognize myself. I don't say, who is he? I don't have to say, who is he? I recognize myself. In the mirror, I can see myself. Similarly, in the mirror of life, it is possible for the conscious mind to look at itself. In the mirror of life. In the mirror of life, the mind is reflected all the time. And therefore, in the mirror of life, in the mirror of relationship, how are we related? If we can look at that, because life is the mirror, and in that mirror of life, everything can be seen. The conscious mind can be seen. We can see the conscious mind and its movement in the mirror of life, in the mirror of relationship. Because relationship is the great mirror in which the mind is all the time projected. We may try to hide, But this mirror shows us where we are, and therefore it is possible for us to see ourselves, to see the conscious mind can look at itself in the mirror of life, in the mirror of relationship. And you will find, as we look at ourselves in the mirror of relationship, and this is the process, because throughout the day this can be done. Throughout the day we can see ourselves in the mirror of life. If we do it, we will find that just as the subconscious mind becomes silent because of the act of observation, the conscious mind also becomes silent because of the act of observation. Observation is the only instrument that we have. If you curb the conscious mind, if you try to control the subconscious, you will fail again and again. It can be brought under the condition of silence only by an act of observation. Observe the subconscious as it acts, as it behaves. Observe the conscious in the mirror of life, in the relationship of life, in the mirror of relationship. Look at the movement of the conscious mind and you will find that the conscious mind has become silent. Remember, it's most interesting to note that Patanjali, in his yoga aphorisms, defines meditation as an act of observation. He says meditation is uninterrupted observation. Where observation has not been interrupted, uninterrupted observation is what meditation is, according to Patanjali. Thus, Patanjali has described concentration. He has described this meditation, but this is not the last point. We move from meditation to a state of communion. Concentration, meditation, and communion, these are the three facets so far as the act of meditation is concerned. We come to communion because the real experience is the experience of communion. Communion is the direct experience. And meditation is the direct experience. It is the direct perception. But the direct perception is there where all the projections of the mind have ceased. There is a perception, the perception which is not ordinarily possible. But there is a perception which comes when the mind has come to a complete state of silence. The subconscious silent, the conscious silent. In that state of silence, where there is no movement of thought, where there is no breeze, so far as thought is concerned, we have come to that silence. In that silence comes the experience of real meditation. The silence has not been enforced. The silence has come because of these acts of observation which we have described. The silence has come in that silence. And there alone, the experience comes. From where it comes, we do not know. It is not the projection of the mind, because all the projections of the mind have ceased. It is something which is intangible, something which cannot be held, something which cannot be possessed, but something which can be experienced. And that is why meditation is indeed a door to the intangible. The intangible is the ground in which tangible can exist usefully. If the ground of the intangible is not there, then the activities of the tangible are meaningless. They are frustrating. They are self-defeating. But when the ground of intangibility is there, and the ground of intangibility is found in this hour of silence, the deep silence, then whatever comes out of this intangibility is what can be described as the real. It is the manifestation. The intangible is the unmanifest, and the unmanifest manifests itself. We are going to go into this question tomorrow morning, the relationship between the manifest and the unmanifest. But the relationship here begins. I have come to the door of the unmanifest, because the silence is the door of the unmanifest. I have come to the door of the unmanifest, and that is the state of communion. This communion, once again, which is known in the language of the Indian language, it is called samadhi. We have very clear notions of samadhi. This is the samadhi. Samadhi is the state of communion, direct perception, direct relationship. That is what samadhi is. And Patanjali defines this samadhi by saying that it is that perception where you see the essence without the form. The form is not there, but you see the essence. Arthamatra nirbhasam, swarupa shunya. That is how Patanjali defines it, that all forms have vanished, they have disappeared, but you see the essence. Is it possible to see the essence without the form? Ordinarily the mind says it is impossible, but it is possible. This is the experience of meditation, to be able to see the essence of things without the form. Because the form, every form, it to a certain extent brings the essence to a condition where it is conditioned and therefore it is not able to show itself freely. When there is the awareness of the essence, the experience of the essence of things, the experience of the being of things, not with the process of becoming. If you and I can meet each other with the awareness of this essence, what we really are, what we have been made by the process of evolution, but what we are, if I can know myself, because yoga, as we saw the other day, is union with ourselves, not union with somebody else. But I must first of all be united with myself. I must know the essence, and the essence can be known only when there is no perception of the form. To see the essence without the perception of the form, that is what is called samadhi. That is the state of communion, concentration, meditation, communion. Patanjali says these three cannot be separated. They must go together. The three together, they form the essence of spiritual discipline. They must go together. If we can do it, then we will find we have come to the sublime, the uplifting experience of meditation. And he who goes out after this experience, even though it may be a momentary experience, is a different man. That experience makes us different. Then we come back to mind, because we have to function with the help of the mind. But it is a different mind. It is not the same mind. In that experience of meditation, the mind is transformed. Then we move about in life with a mind that is completely changed. We are changed just in that moment. In that moment of the experience of essence without the form. In that experience of communion. In that experience of the direct perception with ourselves. Because of that direct perception, it is that direct perception itself that has brought about a change. We know the being of ourselves. Then we can be caught in the process of becoming. But it will never be a frustrating process, because it is the being that expresses itself so far as the process of becoming is concerned. These are just few thoughts with regard to meditation which I have placed before you. Tomorrow morning we shall go into the question of the unmanifest, communicating with the manifest. Because meditation is that communion. Communion where the essence is without the form. It is an experience of communion. It is from that experience of the unmanifest, that we return to the world of manifestation. And when we return to the world of manifestation, we discover that there is a method by which the unmanifest communicates with the manifest. We want to understand what this method of communication is. Because you can see it, how people who have come to the state of communion have communicated, how the saints and mystics have communicated, and what is the nature of that communication. It is to this that we shall turn tomorrow when we consider the subject of the unmanifest communicating with the manifest. This is all meditation. All this is meditation. What we have discussed just now, what we were discussing in the morning today, and what we are going to discuss tomorrow, all this is a part of meditation. This is the process of meditation, starting with relaxation and moving on to concentration, moving on to the generation of energy, so that we become living systems and no longer remain as mechanistic systems. We become living systems, and in these living systems, the experience of concentration, of meditation, and of communion is possible. This is the rough outline so far as the subject of meditation is concerned. You can go on putting colors, whatever colors you want to put, but this is the rough outline so far as this vast subject of meditation is concerned. We must have experience of meditation. Otherwise, as we are tending to become a mechanistic system, we will go on becoming a mechanistic system. Then there is no regeneration that is possible for us. The only possibility of maintaining the secret of regeneration is that we must become a living system, and meditation enables us to remain as a living system and not degenerate into a mechanistic system of mere existence. Thank you very much.